Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Our Making of a Nation series today will tell you about the early history of the American West. Then, Kelly Jean Kelly discusses the United States Supreme Court. But first, this story about science from Pete Musto.
Researchers from all over Africa presented their work at the recent Next Einstein Forum conference in Rwanda. Conference organizers set up the event to provide support for the development of young scientists across Africa. Organizers called it the largest ever gathering of scientists on the continent. South African genetics expert Venet Kodzia spoke at the meeting. She talked about a device to help doctors identify persons with malaria. This could be extremely useful in rural areas since the device does not need blood or even laboratory tests. Kodzia said the device can provide test results quickly, is not costly, and does not require a medical treatment. It can reduce health inequality and bring us one step closer to a world free of malaria, she added. Peter Ngene, a chemistry professor from Nigeria, spoke about nanotechnology, the science of making unimaginably small things. Ngene described how he plans to use extremely small devices to store energy from the sun. He said, "We can go from a dark continent to a bright continent." Rwandan President Paul Kagame is the current head of the African Union. He opened the conference by linking scientific progress to Africa's development at large. Kagame said, "Today, more than ever before, math and science proficiency is a prerequisite for high-income status and the gains in health and well-being that go along with it." For too long, Africa has allowed itself to be left behind, the president added. He noted that as the continent aims to compete on the same level as other areas of the world, it cannot leave out women and girls. Kagame urged Africans not to accept the international custom of men outnumbering women in scientific positions and research. Eliane Ubalejoro is a professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. She noted the large number of women at the conference. Africa falls behind the rest of the world in scientific production. But research on the continent is growing quickly. And a United Nations report showed that some African nations have increased their research and development spending to the level of a middle-income economy. Three examples are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Mali. The Next Einstein Forum was launched in 2013. The forum now supports 19 African science fellows, along with an Africa Science Week at schools in 30 countries. At the meeting last month, the group launched Scientific African, a magazine to publicize new research. It is to be published four times a year. The Forum is a product of the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences. The Institute provides financial aid for students to earn master's degrees in mathematics at centers in Cameroon, Ghana, Rwanda, Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania. More than 1,500 students from 43 African countries have completed their studies through the program since 2003. And 32% of them are women. The program supporting Africans who study mathematics was the idea of South African-born physicist Neil Turok. He grew up as his parents fought apartheid, the country's former system of racial separation. Turok told the conference, "My parents took pride in combating injustice, and they were thrown in jail. It was difficult for me personally, but it was good for my studies because I threw myself into my work." Turok gained success in physics and mathematics. He worked with Stephen Hawking, taught at Princeton University in the United States, and became the director of the Perimeter Institute in Canada. The Institute is an independent research center for experimental physics. His father then urged him to do something for Africa. So he set up the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences in 2003. 10 years later, the next Einstein Forum was launched. Turok says he believes the world's next Albert Einstein can come from Africa. When Africans enter science in large numbers, with their diversity and motivation, they will make massive discoveries, he suggested. Those discoveries are just waiting there to be made. I'm Pete Musto.
Here is a question. Who is the most powerful person in the United States? No, the answer is not the president. The answer is not even one person. Some observers would argue the most powerful people are the 9 judges, called justices, who sit on the Supreme Court. Their decisions affect nearly every part of Americans' lives. Here is lawyer Michael Trachtman. He wrote a book about how important the Supreme Court is.
The Supreme Court defines the distinctions between church and state. The Supreme Court decides how you're treated and what happens to you and what your rights are should you be charged with a crime. The Supreme Court defines your rights if, for example, you are a racial or religious or ethnic minority and you feel as though you are being discriminated against. The Supreme Court defines how your life will be. The Supreme Court defines how
the Supreme Court defines how the U.S. political process works and how laws are made. The court defines the power of the president. The court can make decisions on rules governing technology and business. The court protects Americans' ability to say what they want about what they want. The Supreme Court also defines religious rights, workers' rights, students' rights, property rights, and privacy rights. And it can decide cases involving the right to die, the right to marry, and the right to stand up to employers and public officials.
It's very hard to find anything that the Supreme Court doesn't define and affect in American life.
So, how do the court's members make their important decisions? First, justices are appointed by the president and approved by Congress. Once approved, justices hold their positions for life. Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation notes that justices are not supposed to be political. She says they are supposed to be neutral and fair. Every year, the justices decide to hear about 100 cases. Each case is a real conflict between groups, individuals, or federal and state governments. The Supreme Court does not advise on policy decisions before ruling on a case. After the justices decide what cases to rule on, they read about the history of the legal arguments. They try to learn what judges, lawyers, and other interested parties have said about it. When the justices finally hear the case, the trial usually lasts 1 hour. Both sides have 30 minutes to speak. If the government would like to talk about the case, a government lawyer is limited to half an hour, just like someone representing the opposing side. Linda Greenhouse is a reporter who followed the Supreme Court for 30 years. She says, "The courtroom is not very big. It holds a few hundred people. The justices sit behind a bench, but their seating is raised only about 1 meter above the floor."
The lawyers who were making the arguments stand very close to the justices, and many lawyers, after they make their first argument, have commented on how surprisingly intimate the space feels.
Greenhouse describes the Supreme Court building as having a modest quality, and she notes it is open to visitors. The public can stand in line and try to get a seat to listen to lawyers and justices discussing a case. Supreme Court justices do not announce their decisions on cases right away. Instead, they privately discuss the cases together and sometimes try to persuade each other to accept a way of thinking. For a final ruling, at least 5 of the 9 justices must agree. One or more of those justices is asked to write the majority opinion. Justices who disagree may write a minority opinion. All opinions are released, but the majority opinion is the final ruling. Greenhouse notes that the Supreme Court and its decisions are not always popular among Americans. One of the current disagreements related to the Supreme Court is how the justices should think about, well, thinking. Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation supports an idea called originalism.
This is where judges try to understand how the text was originally understood by the public at the time that it was passed.
In other words, Slattery says justices should try to remain true to the public's understanding of an issue when the law was approved. In cases related to constitutional issues, justices using an originalist interpretation try to consider what Americans thought of the issue in 1789, when the Constitution was enacted. The idea behind this way of thinking, Slattery says, is to prevent justices from letting personal opinions influence their decisions. Reporter Linda Greenhouse supports a different way of thinking. Her term for this is pragmatic. Greenhouse points out that many things have changed since the time the U.S. Constitution was written. For example, many of America's founders accepted slavery. In addition, many did not support equality among people of different races or between women and men. Greenhouse says a pragmatic interpretation considers the U.S. Constitution as a guide to understanding the law in modern society. It is a hope for the future, she says, that permits change. Whatever justices decide, their ruling is final. Unless lawmakers and the public decide to change the Constitution, or unless the Supreme Court overrules itself later. Lawyer and writer Michael Trachtman notes that Supreme Court justices respect the court's earlier decisions. But, he adds, the Supreme Court is not limited by anything that happened in the past. And, he says, over time, the Supreme Court has overturned rulings on many major issues, including guns and same-sex marriage. Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation says the modern Supreme Court aims not to change the laws too quickly. Yes, she says, new information, new situations, or simply new justices can help overturn a ruling. But, she says, the Supreme Court often takes baby steps to make slow change over time. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Next from VOA Learning English, our Making of a Nation series on American history.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Soon after the Civil War ended in 1865, thousands of Americans began to move west to settle the land. The great movement of settlers continued for almost 40 years. The Great Empty West, in time, became fully settled. The discovery of gold had already started a great movement to California. Robert Bostick and Leo Scully tell about the gold rush and the important part cowboys played in settling the West.
Men had rushed to the gold fields with hopes of becoming rich. A few found gold. The others found only hard work and high prices. When their money was gone, they gave up the search for gold. But they stayed in California to become farmers or businessmen or laborers. Some never gave up the search for riches. They moved back toward the east, searching for gold and silver in the wild country between California and the Mississippi River.
Each new gold rush brought more people from the east. Mining camps quickly grew into towns with stores, hotels, even newspapers. Most of these towns, however, lived only as long as gold was easy to find. Then they began to die. In some of the gold centers, big mining companies bought up all the land from those who first claimed it. These companies brought in mining machines that could dig out the gold from deep underground and separate it from the rock that held it. These companies needed equipment and other supplies. Transportation companies were formed. They carried supplies to the mining camps in huge wagon trains pulled by slow-moving oxen. Roads were built, and in some places, railroads.
The great wealth taken from the gold and silver mines was usually invested in other businesses: shipping, railroads, factories, stores, land companies. More jobs were created in the West, and living conditions got better. More and more people decided to leave the crowded East for a new life in the West. but the big eastern cities continued to grow. New factories and industrial centers were built. People moved from the farms to find work in the cities.
The growth of these industrial centers created a big demand for food, especially meat. Chicago quickly became the heart of the meat industry. Railroads brought animals to Chicago, where packing companies killed them and prepared the meat for eastern markets. Special railroad cars kept the meat cold so it would remain fresh until sold. As the meat industry grew, the demand for fresh meat increased. More and more cattle were needed.
There were millions of cattle in Texas, but no way to get them to the eastern markets. The closest point on the railroad was Sedalia, Missouri, more than 1,000 kilometers away. Some cattlemen believed it might be possible to walk cattle to the railroad, letting them feed on the open grassland along the way. Early in 1866, a group of Texas cattlemen decided to try this. They put together a huge herd of more than 260,000 cattle and set out for Sedalia.
There were many problems on that first cattle drive. The country was rough, grass and water sometimes hard to find. Bandits and Indians followed the herd, trying to steal cattle. Farmers had put up fences in some areas, blocking the way. Most of the great herd was lost along the way, but the cattlemen believed they had proved that cattle could be walked long distances to the railroad. They believed a better way to the railroad could be found, with plenty of grass and water.
The cattlemen got the Kansas Pacific Railroad to extend its line west to Abilene, Kansas. There was a good trail from Texas to Abilene. Cattlemen began moving their herds up this trail, across the Oklahoma Territory, and into Kansas. At Abilene, the cattle were put on trains and carried to Chicago. In the next 4 years, more than 1.5 million cattle were moved north over the Chisholm Trail to Kansas. Other trails were found as the railroad moved farther west.
Trail drives usually began with the spring roundup. Cattlemen would send out cowboys to search the open grasslands for their animals. As the cattle were brought in, the young animals were branded, marked, to show who owned them. Then they were released with their mothers to spend another year in the open country. The other cattle were put together for the long drive to Kansas. Usually, they were moved in groups of 2,500 to 5,000 animals. 12 to 20 cowboys took them up the trail.
The cowboys worked hard on a trail drive. They had to keep the herd together day and night and protect it from bad men and Indians. They had to keep the cattle from moving too fast or running away. If they moved too fast, they would lose weight, and their owner would not get as much money for them. The cowboys would walk the cattle only 20 to 30 kilometers a day. The cattle could feed all night and part of the morning before starting each day. If the grass was good and the herd moved slowly, the cattle would get heavier and bring more money.
In the early 1880s, the price of cattle rose to $50 each, and many cattlemen became rich. Business was so good that a $5,000 investment in the cattle industry could make $45,000 in 4 years. More and more people began raising cattle, and early cattlemen greatly increased the size of their herds. Within a few years, there was not enough grass for all the cattle, especially along the trails. There was so much meat that the price began to fall.
There were two severe winters that killed hundreds of thousands of cattle. An extremely dry summer killed the grass, and thousands more died of hunger. The cattle industry itself almost died. Cattlemen also had problems with farmers and sheepmen. Farmers coming west would claim grassland used by the cattle growers. They would put up fences and plow up the land to plant crops. Other settlers brought huge herds of sheep to compete with cattle for the grass, and the sheep always won. Cattle would not eat grass where sheep had eaten. Violence broke out. Cattle growers fought the farmers and sheepmen for control of the land. The cattlemen finally had to settle land of their own, putting up fences and cutting the size of their herds. They no longer could let their cattle run free on public lands.
By the late 1800s, the years of the cowboys were ending. But the story of the cowboy and his difficult life would not be forgotten. Even today, the cowboy lives in movies, on television, and in books. When one thinks of the Wild West of America, he does not think of the miners who opened the way to the West. Nor does he think of the men who struggled to build the first railroads across the wild land. And one does not think of the farmers who pushed slowly westward to fence, plow, and plant the land.
The words Wild West bring to mind just one character, the cowboy. His difficult fight to protect his cattle on the long trail was an exciting story. It has been told by many writers. Perhaps the best known was a young Easterner, Owen Wister. He worked as a cattleman for several years, then wrote about the heroic life of the cowboy in a book called The Virginian. Another Easterner who came west to learn about the cowboy was the artist Frederick Remington. Remington was a cowboy for only 2 years, but he spent the rest of his life painting pictures of the West and writing about it. His exciting works made the West and the cowboy come to life for millions who never saw a real cowboy.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.